You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of January 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. Coming up on today's programme, I'll discuss the day's top news stories with Isabel Hilton and James Rogers. An inquiry into the murder of former Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko suggests that Vladimir Putin was probably involved. But will the report change anything? We'll be having that debate. Then, one prominent US media outlet has just named Germany the world's best country. The US came fourth, if you're wondering. We'll find out why. And a little later, as people self-identify as global citizens, some are going as far as carrying a world passport of dubious legal validity. But is such a document needed in a globalised world? All that plus a look at a geopolitical spat in the Taiwan Straits. And we'll ask if Davos is worth all the trouble. That's ahead here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Yes, a warm welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Rogers, senior lecturer in journalism at City University London. Both of them regular Monocle 24 contributors, and welcome both to the programme. Let's start today with some pretty big news here in the UK. An inquiry into the murder of ex-Russian spy Alexander Litvinenko by poisoning back in 2006 has concluded the assassination was probably approved by Russia's President Vladimir Putin. Theresa May, Britain's Home Secretary, said the murder was a blatant and unacceptable breach of international law. Russia, in turn, has denied the allegations, calling the inquiry politicised. James, perhaps we'll start with you. You were the man in Moscow for a certain public broadcaster based pretty near us here in London. At the time of this murder, I guess let's go back to then. What are your recollections of how this was covered, I suppose, at that point?
Completely varying interpretations, of course, which we see echoed very much today. I mean, at the time, Russian state media put up all sorts of former KGB officers, all sorts of security experts on the main evening television news there explaining why this couldn't possibly be what it seemed to be, and it certainly wasn't what the British authorities were alleging. Shortly afterwards, a team from Scotland Yard came to Moscow to talk to the suspects, those who remain the suspects in the case, and of course have been named in the report which this inquiry has produced today. So, and I think we see in the responses here, we see Mr. Putin's spokesman Dmitry Peskov calling this a quasi-investigation today. He's stressing the probable and the possibles which have appeared in the report and really being entirely dismissive of it. And as we see here, of course, we've got British politicians, the British Prime Minister included, saying that this is a very serious conclusions and that there may indeed be more consequences.
Isabel, we'll come on to the actual tenor, I suppose, of the report in a moment. What about, again, going back? I mean, how much has changed in the, decade since? Clearly the world's a very different place, but do you think that the immediate sort of dynamic surrounding this case, surrounding Putin, has changed inexorably since then? Or do you think that the fundamental questions then are the same ones now, and whether they've been addressed in this report is another issue?
Well, the fundamental questions of whether a sovereign state, you know, what you do if at the head of a sovereign state orders an assassination of someone in your country. I mean, that hasn't changed. I guess what has changed is the position of Russia. You know, Russia has gone down and then has come back up onto the international stage in a particularly problematic way. You know, Ukraine, Crimea, and now Syria. That I think that you know, part of the context of how the British government will react is bound to be conditioned by Russia's position, by the degree to which Russia is judged being helpful or unhelpful in Syria, by the degree to which Russia can be challenged, or Putin can be challenged effectively. No government, whilst the British government will wish to be seen to be doing something, they will have to think quite carefully about whether there is much they can do, you know, that won't make them look more impotent, honestly.
Well, that's an interesting point, actually, in terms of the British government. James, I wonder, do you think that this notion that Putin was probably involved, will the UK government be happy with that verdict? It's actually rather problematic in terms of how they respond. Well, is it almost the most difficult possible outcome.
I think British security and diplomatic circles who keep a close eye on Russia have long suspected that that was probably the case anyway. I mean, I think the interesting...
But with it in black and white, I don't know, does that... Does it make it more tricky?
Well, I mean, I think it's not as entirely in black and white as perhaps they would like. I mean, but I think that's the way that everybody is going to read it. I mean, I think one thing which was interesting at the time was that the response then was limited to a couple of diplomatic tit-for-tat expulsions, as they're called. At the time, there was a massive British economic involvement in Russia, and a growing one indeed, because at the time when this was going on, and there was a very frank exchange of diplomatic views when Mr. Litvinenko was murdered, at the same time British chain stores were opening big branches. I remember getting briefings from British diplomats in Moscow, and a couple of hundred metres away a huge shopping mall was opening with representations from big British retailers. That of course has largely gone, or to a very big extent, because of the sanctions which have followed the annexation of Crimea. So it's a little difficult to know, and Mr. Cameron has noted himself today that Britain and Russia have to have some kind of working relationship over Syria. So it's a little difficult to know what more really the British government can do.
Mm. Isabel, we talked a little bit about the responses, maybe predictable as some of them were, from Putin's spokespeople and that sort of thing. But again, to go back to that idea, his probable involvement, and you were discussing right at the top, this, you know, it's still shocking to describe collusion of, you know, the leader of a state in this kind of enterprise, if that's what we're suggesting. How will the verdict of this report play, do you think, more broadly in Moscow? Clearly, Putin, one imagines, won't be that troubled. Could that change anything?
I don't think it would change much in Moscow, because, for one thing, Putin has form in this in this respect. You know, there are a number of people who have met untimely deaths in circumstances that suggest that it was at least pleasing to Putin. One notorious case of a prominent journalist was killed on his birthday, and you know, was a really a thorn in his flesh. So I think that, you know, this is not going to alter the political balance in Moscow, because those who believe that Putin was involved, you know, will not be surprised. And those who are willing to take the official story, you know, are not going to change their view because the British suggest they should. So I think that won't shift anything. And Russia, after all, has long refused to hand over the two men last seen having tea with the victim. So, you know, I think this is a confirmation, if you like, of what was long, of, you know, very long established suspicions. But I'm not sure that it's a game changer.
Given how sort of brazen the suggestion is that the involvement was, and you think of the response to, with some of the suspects like Andrei Lugovoy, for example, being given a parliamentary seat, always being helped to facilitate his claims of innocence. Is that the worst we'll see? Or do you think that the fact that, you know, if you look at it in these terms, Putin has, in quotes, been seen to get away with it, will strengthen his resolve further to continue with this sort of enterprise?
I mean, I think there's one important thing to remember about the way that the Russian political elite particularly is made up. I mean, there's been a lot of research done on the number of ex-members of the security services, Mr. Putin himself, of course, included in that number, who are represented at the top levels of Russian politics and business, which overlap very substantially. And I think also among Russian public opinion, there will be a feeling that Mr. Litvinenko largely got what he deserved. And I think if you look at the way, certainly the way they'll be seen in security services, there's a saying in Russian that there's no such thing as a former KGB man. In other words, if you've ever been in the service or the FSB or any of its successor agencies, then really you're part of that clan or that tribe for good. And I think those people who are seen as traitors to it, are seen in very poor terms. And I think that there will be very little sympathy in certain circles in Russia for the fate which Mr. Litvinenko met.
I mean, that's an interesting point. I guess that's the play within intelligence circles. Certainly within the military, we know these stories, anecdotally or otherwise, of, you know, his Litvinenko's face being used in target practice and all this sort of thing. But does that speak to the wider population? I mean, is there a demographic, presumably somewhere there must be, who actually think, you know, maybe look at the report in more detail and, I don't know, push to at least internally ask some more challenging questions about their administration?
Well, no, I think that there will be some people who are wondering about the extent of the involvement. I think that the Russian media, of course, will be pretty careful about this one, with some exceptions, and those ones, those independent media which do remain in Russia are pretty careful about, remain fairly careful about what they say these days. And there will be people who will think about it. But again, I think Perhaps the most interesting response which has come from Moscow, I think, is probably the suggestion that this was politicized. I was absolutely certain beforehand that this was going to be the word that was going to come out. It's the word that they've used all along. It remains a fact that because there isn't an independent judiciary in Russia, Russia doesn't believe there's one anywhere else. And they will believe that the court, the inquiry will have been directed from the top levels of Downing Street.
And there's perhaps not much that can be done to dissuade them of that notion. Let's move on to the Strait of Taiwan now, where China's engaged in live-fire drills and mock landings as part of a wide range of military exercises. Now, the cynical observer might suggest these displays could in some way be related to the recent election of the pro-independence party's leader to the presidency of Taiwan mere days earlier. Isabel,
shocked that you should think there's a connection. Heavens, who could have thought that? This is standard stuff again. China has been in a pretty robustly, bullying mode towards its territories that it regards as its own. It's been behaving very badly in Hong Kong, and clearly it's very displeased with the outcome of this election. This is warra, warra, warra. This is, kind of shouting. And I think that we're a long way short of any serious action, but they're trying to make sure that the Taiwanese don't get above themselves, that the new president Tsai, is quite clear that she's dealing with something quite dangerous. She's an extremely moderate and reasonable person. She knows China well. She's been a negotiator with China in the Cross Straits relations. She's not somebody who's going to prod the tiger in any dangerous way. But I think that this was entirely anticipated, and she'll take it in her stride.
We'll talk a bit more about what's in Tsai's in tray in a moment. James, I just wonder, Isabel's clearly alluded to it there, the idea of, self-determination, whatever, for various of these territories is clearly remains of understandably fundamental importance to Beijing. Do you think that it is viewed there as a purely domestic matter, or is there an international dimension as well when it comes to Beijing's thinking?
Well, I think there's always an international dimension. I think whenever a country responds like this to any territory, it has got its eye on at least two audiences, being the domestic and the international one. I mean, I think it's interesting when we look at the way that this Chinese response has been to show this TV footage of military exercises, and then to mount what's a Facebook trolling campaign. I mean, these are the ways that diplomacy is often conducted in the modern world. So, and I think, as Isabella has very rightly pointed out, we're a long way short of a serious crisis, but clearly the Chinese government just wants to remind or to very strongly suggest where the limits to this lie.
One sense is well, so I can probably handle, some Facebook interventions from various netizens, what a horrible word that is. But what about the bigger picture? What does her task really look like now? I mean, clearly she's done a fairly good job at positioning herself, to still be seen to be, a voice for an independence movement, but to be maybe slightly more conciliatory so as not to alarm Beijing too much. How does she negotiate that kind of fairly delicate balancing act, do you think?
Well, I think we have to look at who she's taking over from. The Kuomintang under Ma Ying-jeou definitely moved cross-strait relations into a degree of intimacy that was clearly the electorate was uncomfortable with. And over the period in which Ma Ying-jeou was moving towards Beijing, you had things like the umbrella movement in Hong Kong, which knocks a bit of a hole in one country, two systems, at least the Chinese response to it, and that has got worse since. And then you had the sunflower movement in Taiwan, which was partly in response to Hong Kong. So the idea that these two systems could grow together with the progressive liberalization of mainland China has taken a severe knock under Xi Jinping. You've got a securitization of the state, you've got very heavy-handed party control, moving the middle ground, really, people in the middle ground are either being locked up or silenced. So the people of Taiwan who, have been enjoying the benefits of a maturing democracy suddenly thought, hang on a minute, the closer we get to China, this is at the cost of our civil and political liberties. This is not a case of China moving towards us. So I think that what that her task really is to reassure her electorate that it won't go any further and she won't be bullied into it going any further. Her problem is a degree of economic dependence. There are huge Taiwanese investments in China. Part of the good side of the flowering of cross-straits relationship has been greater exchange between populations. Although there was one threat that if things went too far in Taiwan, Beijing would restrict the flow of Chinese tourists to Taiwan, at which point someone from Hong Kong tweeted, do you think they could punish Hong Kong in the same way? So these things are always slightly double-edged, you know. But I think that, you know, the mainland has been very systematic at trying to exclude Taiwan from all kinds of multilateral bodies like the World Health Organization. I mean, quite normal things that Taiwan needs to be part of. So defending the diplomatic ground that Taiwan still has, and it's relatively slight, is going to be her main challenge, I think.
We're going to take a short break now on Midori House. I'll be back with James Rogers and Isabel Hilton right after this.
Monocle's new hospitality issue looks at how everything from nations to airports, hotels to brands rolls out the welcome mat.
In the design section, we discover the artists, sign painters, and typographers restoring, reviving, and preserving the lettering that defines our cities. We visit one of the GDR's most famous tower blocks, now home to a coterie of Berlin creatives.
In the edit section, we head to Lebanon to meet the locals spurning the big chain openings and keeping their hotels in family hands. Then I sit down with the man behind the world's best-known Japanese restaurants for Nobu Matsuhitsa's last meal in Miami. The February issue of Monocle is on newsstands now. Get your copy today or plan ahead with a Monocle subscription from monocle.com.
We're raising the curtain on a brand new show here on Monocle 24 devoted to the best in cinema. Tune in every week to hear from filmmakers, critics, and luminaries of the genre as we shine a spotlight on everything from revivals and the restoration of vintage cuts to Hollywood's golden age and the role of the auteur.
I never think of architecture or cities or landscapes in cinema as merely being a kind of neutral backdrop to the action. They are the action themselves.
Hear feature-length interviews with the biggest names, roundtable discussions, special reports, and more as Monocle 24 delves into the rich history of the silver screen. The cinema show on Monocle 24 in association with Mubi, premiering Fridays at 20:00 London time, because life is too short for bad films.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, almost 1818 here in London, still with me, James Rogers, Senior Lecturer in Journalism at City University London, and Isabel Hilton, Editor of China Dialogue. Now, we're no strangers to rankings here at Monocle. Our annual Quality of Life Index springs to mind, but is it possible to rank countries themselves on a whole? The US News and World Report has just released their list of the world's best countries, and the top spot goes to Germany. What do we make of this one, James? I mean, we tend to sort of focus in on quality of life. We look at things like how effective nations are at wielding soft power, rather specific. Is it possible, do you think, to, in a meaningful way, be ranked simply the best?
I think it's difficult because I would imagine, I'd like to know what prompted them to carry this out, actually, because one might imagine that they sort of thought, well, they would embark on this in the sure and certain knowledge that the United States would come top, and unfortunately it hasn't turned out that way for them. I mean, I think there are some of these rankings which are quite useful, the ones which are done, for example, for expatriates living there or for business people or businesses who are considering relocating in terms of, you know, what the cost of living there is, or the cost of accommodation or transport or so on, or the difficulty or otherwise of doing business there. But this one seems to be a lot more sort of a wide-ranging. And I suppose it's not entirely surprising the ones which have come towards the top, but given that it's a survey in the United States, I mean, most of the United States media who've covered it seem to be expressing some dismay that they're not top. There was a report in one of the newspapers in London here this morning about this very same survey, which was rejoicing the fact that Britain had come third, but not rejoicing the fact that it scored very poorly on the inhabitants' sex appeal and not surprisingly, the weather.
Well, so, some things you just can't do that much about.
The weather, at least.
I'll leave our listeners' imaginations to see which of those I'm talking about. It's I suppose that's an interesting point, though. You know, particularly if you think about Germany being at number one on this list. I mean, it is only, you go back a couple of generations, there'll be lots of people still in Germany who surely would have thought this such a day could never come. I mean, that's, I suppose, a rather remarkable.
I think it's remarkable. And actually, I was rather pleased to see it, because I think that, you know, the way Germany has behaved in the last couple of years in Europe is pretty impressive. And particularly last year over the migrants, you know. And I think that maybe we finally closed a chapter in our perceptions of Germany, which would, you know, not perhaps be before time, and
no,
that's
indeed.
Important. I found this kind of puzzling, though, because it does seem as though this is these are opinions culled from all over the world, but it does read in some ways, apart from the fact that the US did not come top, it doesn't read as though it reads rather like a US view of the world. So, for instance, if you're looking at cultural influence, Italy and France are very high up there. South Korea, huge cultural influence. South Korea, along with Mexico, is one of the primary producers, for instance, of soap operas and in popular music and popular culture. It's massive across Asia, but of course not in Europe and not so much in Europe and not in the United States. So there's an awful lot of, hang on a minute, you know, in this, as you go through the detail. Why is India a number one mover? Why is Brazil ranked so high when Brazil's in recession? You know, it does seem as though some fine print has been missed out here in terms of what people really understand about the countries they're looking at.
But I guess prompting these sorts of discussions, though, is almost
one part of
the objective.
But I think my favourite part of it is not so much that the US came third, but that they came behind Canada, which we know is going to upset them terribly.
Rather than not winning, but Canada at number two... Again, one wonders whether that's deliberately antagonistic. But what explains that? I mean, is it a lot of people talking about the sort of Trudeau effects? I mean, is there a reason for this resurgence?
I mean, it's scored number one. Canada has scored number one for quality of life and number two for citizenship. So possibly that is a reflection of, and we've seen Mr. Trudeau talking about that again this week. And possibly that's one of the reasons why. But yes, given that. As far as one understands, Canada's quite a frequent butt of United States-based jokes, so it probably will rather annoy them that if they're bad enough to come not to come top, but to come behind Canada, particularly bad, probably.
We'll maybe talk a bit more about some of these global views when we talk about being a global citizen in just a moment or two. But let's head next into the High Alps, the World Economic Forum. Inescapably, is taking place in Davos. And yet again, we've been checking with our friends at Bloomberg about the various workshops, conversations, bilaterals that are happening. But we've also been asking our guests here at Midori House, particularly on this programme, whether Davos is, I don't know how to put too fine a point on it, worth it. Isabel, what do you make of this? Is it a talking shop? Are we dealing with empty rhetoric? Is there real value here? What's your view of the week? I feel constrained
to point out that since you're asking two people who are here in your studio in London and not in Davos, you ought to perhaps aim off a little bit for that. But I was struck by the fact that Davos, you know, suddenly woke up to the fact that climate change was a threat to the world economy. And I felt, well, you know, glad to have you aboard, boys. But, you know, where were you 10 years ago? Well, this has been fairly clear for quite a long time. So I feel that Davos, you know, lives in its own bubble, and it presents itself as a kind of trendsetter and leader. But actually, in terms of the big issues, I'm not sure that it's entirely up to speed. And I came across this rather wonderful Davos bingo card.
Excellent.
Which is full of kind of buzzwords. So it's buzzword bingo, and it's things like virtual reality, amplify, ecosystem, party invitation. But the other thing about Davos is that you're always worried about whether you're invited to the right parties, because you have a badge, but it's never good enough. It's never as good as the, you know, Clinton or Obama's badge. You know, digital disruptors, future finance, and you have this tsunami of buzzwords. And really, what does it change? What changes as a result of Davos? I've never seen any kind of real game-changing thinking come out of Davos, though I'm sure a lot of deals are done.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I imagine that the important stuff at Davos goes on behind the scenes, because, I mean, a lot of the things that, you know, the big interviews we've seen in the media in the last few days have really, to a large extent, been a statement of the obvious. You know, Davos realises that the world economy is in a sort of parlous state. Well, one would hope so, if these are the people who are supposed to be running it. But anybody who reads the newspapers or watches TV would have known that as well. And I think, the access thing is interesting. I mean, it's elites within elites within elites. I heard a story this week of a journalist from another EU country who had been bumped out of his hotel room in the town itself, apparently because he wasn't important. I don't know, but anyway, he was forced subsequently to seek another in a town about an hour and a half away by train. So obviously either he or his publication wasn't considered important enough.
I think also, you know, Davos has been a kind of forum for, if you like, the masters of the universe. And in the last 25 years, when that particular elite might have felt that things were going really well for them because they were accumulating more and more of the world's resources and, you know, their power was pretty much unchallenged and so on. It's kind of interesting to know what the mood is now when the world economy doesn't seem to be in good shape, when there's more and more concern about wealth inequality, when it's quite clear, and it has been clear since the global financial crisis, that this system is not infallible and it's not going to last forever. You know, how much of those real conversations, I wonder, are going on in Davos?
It was interesting that this week was the Oxfam report about inequalities and the top, you know, 60 people owning the same amount of wealth as the bottom half of the entire planet. It was interesting, that seemed to almost frame all of the discussion from the week's start, which, I don't know, that seemed a little different. Maybe there is a bit more of a conscience developing. Is that too much to hope?
I don't know.
For,
I mean, I think Isabel makes a very good point about maybe they are starting to realise that these things last forever. I mean, any look at the world for the last 25 years will tell you that. For if you think of the way that, you know, the Soviet Union disappeared, something that was never imagined in the middle of the last century. But it may be that if important things do happen at Davos, these reflections about maybe this system won't last forever are probably happening behind the scenes and perhaps in a slightly anxious way. But we don't really get that in a lot of these big sort of scene-setting conference presentations or media interviews where it is, you know, very much stuff that really not particularly controversial or provocative. But I suspect the fact that all these people, who after all are people who do not tend to waste their time, whether they've made their success in politics or in business, would not go there if they weren't getting something out of it, other than a bit of TV coverage.
A few of those marginal bilaterals get some real work done. We'll have to wait and see. Finally on the programme, the rapper Yasin Bey, otherwise known as Mos Def, was arrested in South Africa on the 14th of January. He was accused of trying to leave the country using an unrecognised passport. It turns out the document was a so-called world passport issued by the World Service Authority. This goes back to the 50s when Gary Davis, a former Broadway actor and bomber pilot, renounced his US citizenship and called himself a citizen of the world. Since then, it's claimed that over 180 countries have at one point or another recognised these passports by stamping a visa or exit or entry stamp, but their official status is still dubious at best. As well, should they be? Isn't this a rather elegant concept? We talked earlier about people around the world and their views of one another. Surely there could be nothing more, I don't know, inclusive than a global passport.
Completely. And I think, you know, we'll all be speaking Esperanto by next week. I think we're in the same territory here. I can't think what he was thinking of. I mean, was he not able to renew his passport? Did he really think, or is he rather desperate for publicity? Or I mean, the idea that in today's world, where after all the United States has just cancelled all its ESTAs, you know, its permission to visit the United States, and we're all going to have to reapply and go through extra security checks. The notion that a world passport issued, you know, out of some dusty office in Manhattan was going to get you on a flight seems to me,
misguided at best.
Misguided, optimistic.
What do you make about it, though? I think there's something fairly charming about this. I mean, should we not, you know, support people who display this kind of, I don't know, idealism, perhaps?
I think there is something fairly charming. I mean, it doesn't, don't gather from the reports where he was trying to travel to, but I think he'd have fairly short shrift trying to arrive in the United States or in the Russian Federation or any parts of the EU, for that matter. I mean, I think it is a nice idea, but in some ways, I think it's either an idea which has had its time or whose time has yet to come. I don't think it's an idea that's likely to work at the moment. I mean, otherwise, one imagines there'll be lots of people fleeing the many conflicts in the world who would be trying very hard to lay their hands upon just such a document for the access it would give them to a better life. So, but unfortunately, it doesn't seem to be the way that the world is going at the moment.
So good marks for idealism, but maybe a little short on the practicalities.
Well, indeed. I mean, there is a sort of world passport, which is a UN document, a laissez-passer for people who don't have citizenship. And I have known people who have that. But they do have quite a lot of trouble getting into countries, not so much getting out. But they do have trouble getting in.
Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you both very much indeed for being with us. On today's Midori House, that was Isabel Hilton and James Rogers. My thanks to them both. Thanks too to our producer, Daniel Giacopelli, and research team, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and Federica Romagnello, and our studio manager, Chris Chilvers. Carlotta Rabello is playing you music from around the world. Next, join Andrew Tuck for The Urbanist at 1900. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow, 1800, here in London, but from the Thursday team here on Midori House in London. Have a great day wherever in the world you are. Thanks for tuning in.